say, anyhow, they will not give me his address, other than it being in London. Of course, he's not on good terms with the president.
No. There is a Zaire, and you probably should interview.
Oh, really? To continue now, you mentioned Connor Cruz O'Brien, who later became the United Nations representative in Elizabethville. Did you know him before he went to the Congo, or did you know him after that?
I think it's hard for me to remember. I think I knew him after that. Yes, after that.
Could you give your impression of Connor Cruz O'Brien? As you no doubt know, his stay in Elizabethville was somewhat controversial, and different things have been written, including the things that he has written. How would you characterize Connor Cruz O'Brien?
Well, I think Connor is mad, brilliant, extraordinarily brilliant, a person of many disguises and guises. He writes under several names. He's, if I may be excused of putting it this way, he's wonderfully Irish. He comes from a nationalist royal family, as does his wife, and they summarize it between the two of them, all the complexities and ambiguities of being the universal intellectual, highly sophisticated, and also deeply rooted in Irish circumstances, through which he tended to interpret African independence.
Yeah. And did you have opportunity to discuss the developments in the Congo, and particularly in the Katanga, with him later?
Yes, but not terribly much, because by the time I got to know him, he was vice-chancellor of the University of Ghana, and having his own battles with Kwame Nkrumah, who wanted to make it more of an ideological rather than an intellectual place. And at this point, Connor Cruz O'Brien appeared very much in the terms of the traditional English academic defending academic freedom, which was a very different guise from the one, the role he played in the Congo. I think he's a supreme manipulator. Although I think he's very conscious of manipulating always for the side of virtue. He also, as a brilliant intellectual, decides what virtue is. Some people might call that opportunism, but I don't think he felt that way, and I don't really think it was that way. He's a radical in the real sense of the term, but not an ideologue.
Radical liberalist, would you say?
Yes.
Liberal?
Yeah, liberal, but a radical liberal. A rad lib, I think they used to call it in the old days. Very idiosyncratic, impatient with any kind of bureaucracy, very hard on the people who worked with him, who could neither keep up with his intellectual leaps, his inconsistencies as a personality. And of course, he drank an enormous amount, and he always had the feeling that the more he drank, the sharper he got, and that wasn't unfortunately necessarily the case. He fought with almost everybody, as I recall. But he had a thing about Lumumba. He rather liked Lumumba. Or I think he liked the idea of Lumumba, that there would be somebody who could come to represent the center, and a kind of radical center, which no other figure was able to shake off localism and ethnicity the way Lumumba could. Lumumba just didn't care about that. And Lumumba may have had a small tribal following, but that wasn't the basis of his support. And I think that's what appealed to Connor Cruz O'Brien.
Yes, in his writings he has portrayed Lumumba in that sense and has suggested, more than suggested, that the murder of Lumumba was arranged by the CIA, and that in this Dag Hammarskjöld had a certain role. And my question here is, in your conversations with him later, did any of this antipathy to Dag Hammarskjöld come out? Was there any explanation?
Yes, I think he thought Dag Hammarskjöld was a stuffed shirt, a real... I think Connor really didn't have a great respect for the United Nations. There were very few people who did, as I recall. While he was the representative of the United Nations, it only confirmed him in his through his experience of what he'd known about it all along. And Dag Hammarskjöld seemed to him to be the personification of the pious, inept, manipulative, pro-Western, deceitful figure who, because he was Swedish, seemed always to escape the kind of judgments and evaluations that he deserved.
Well, Conor Cruise O'Brien certainly did his part to make that evaluation. Those are the questions I had. Were there any other thoughts that come to you that you'd like to or feel would be worth recording here concerning the impressions you gained at that stage of the Congo just before independence?
Well, just a few things. One was the sense of the terrible backwardness of the country, because it was not only in Congo, but also in Rwanda and Burundi. And upcountry...
Which were also Belgian.
Yes.
Administered.
And upcountry, one had the feeling of people really up against it. The extraordinary problem of overpopulation. The intense conflict between the Watusi and the Bahutu, and and now I'm in a certain sense reflecting a comment with a governor general of Rwanda. Virtually no preparation at the level of local administration, and that includes medical facilities and. Just ordinary local government and so on. No preparation whatsoever for the change that would take place. And my experience was similar the minute you got away from places like Elizabethville, or even in Elizabethville itself. There was simply no preparation for self-government. What there was the dickering and bargaining amongst different African politicians and senior administrators. There was one in particular whose name I've forgotten, who was very famous and a brilliant man, who himself knew perfectly well what was going to happen and simply tried to put the best face on it that he could.
This was a Belgian.
This is a Belgian. You would know his name immediately. I'm really terrible. That I've forgotten names, but I haven't been thinking about this for many, many years. This man, I think, was second in command of the process, but was in Leopoldville. And I had met him on a number of occasions and talked to him. And he just accepted what had now become inevitable as high policy, but took the position that what the Belgians were doing in terms of Africa, not a question of ideology about colonialism or anti-colonialism, it was a human phenomenon that would produce a terrible disaster. I think everybody knew, right throughout the system, everybody had a foretaste of doom, but almost nobody knew on the American side. The American side, I remember talking to Helen Kitchen about this, just assumed that independence comes the way babies are born. It all happens naturally. And, you know, they're sure there'd be some kinds of trauma associated with the birth, but this would all be handled in due course. there was no sense of the really the kind of ferocious conflicts that were incipient, and that I find surprising. Although at the time there were virtually no Americans working in Zaire on a scholarly basis. A little bit later there were somebody who teaches, I think, at Brooklyn College, who you may know of.
I think I've heard of one man.
Who he knows a lot.
Because it's interesting that Hammarskjöld seems to have anticipated real trouble there and had sent Ralph Bunches, you no doubt know,
yes,
there to be there for the independence, but also to stay on beyond independence.
I've forgotten that.
Which he did, actually, and met with the cabinet in its first meeting.
I might just add on one other note, which doesn't have anything to do particularly with the Congo. I knew Sir Andrew Cohen quite well, and knew him in Uganda. We became friends. I knew him when he was no longer governor of Uganda, but had become the representative to the United Nations, I think, Trusteeship Council. So I used to go to the UN quite regularly with him and got a sense of the interior workings, how the British would get things done through the Indian delegations, for example, and the kind of trade-offs and bargaining that used to go on. And Sir Andrew Cohen was a kind of Fabian socialist and had strong views and convictions about African nationalism, and felt that this was a positive rather than a negative thing, unlike many of his counterparts in the colonial office. But that was probably throughout his period as ambassador of the Trusteeship Council, I would go quite regularly to the UN, and so that's the part of the UN I know best. I used to be seated with the British delegation, and that, I think, came after my own personal association with the Kennedy administration and the formation of African policy. So it was interesting to sort of move from the American to the international perspective, while still going back and forth to Africa periodically.
That does raise one other question. Kennedy became president right in the middle of the Congo crisis, and there was, I really believe, a distinct substantive change in U.S. policy at that time toward the Congo. Were you in a position to advise the Kennedy administration on Africa, and in particular on the Congo?
Well, yes and no. I was part of that, as I think I mentioned to you, that five-man task force that George Ball set up, and we were supposed to be responsible for drafting the Kennedy policy for Africa.
Before the inauguration.
Before the inauguration. And I think the other members of that committee were Helen Kitchen, is it Helen Kitchen or Ruth Sloan?
Ruth Sloan, I believe.
I think it was Ruth Sloan, yes. James Coleman, Vernon McKay, and somebody from the American Metals Climax, whose name I've forgotten, but it will come back to me. Who was supposedly the spokesman for Central African affairs and Congo, but he didn't know very much about the Congo. He had a good sense, I think, of because of copper and what was going on in the Katanga, but I don't think he knew much about the rest of the Congo. Nobody did, and at the time, as I recall, the big preoccupation was the two main preoccupations were Central African Federation and Guinea-Ghana-Mali, the group of the left, how far left they would go, and in particular what should be the American role towards Ghana if the move to the left continued, especially in terms of such things as the Volta development scheme. And later, after that, my personal position, which I remember better than the others, was that at this point not to take a stand that would in any way play into the hands of the left, but just be rather cool about the whole thing. Partly because the term left had a certain degree of paranoia associated with it, which if you got on the ground tended to disappear very rapidly. Yeah. And that a good deal of what was called African socialism was just simply state capitalism, in which people plundered happily from the inside of the organization. And on the whole, that advice was taken. Then I became a member of the African Advisory Board or something like that, and which would meet periodically. And the then Assistant Secretary of State, who was a friend of mine, would periodically ask me about specific things. One of the most important issues was, in fact, the Volta scheme. Mm. And the Volta scheme was one of these remarkable things which gave extraordinarily favorable terms to the Kaiser Corporation. This was partly because of the original aluminium company that was supposed to go into it was a Canadian company, Alcoa, and they withdrew. Once they withdrew, the Ghanaians panicked a bit, and this was to be their main centerpiece for development after independence, and a token of their entry into what could be regarded as the developmental world as distinct from the world of nationalism. That, in fact, that's the way Nkrumah presented it through K.A. Betima, his Minister of Finance, and especially to the United States, and in the person of Adlai Stevenson, whom I originally met in Betima's house in Accra, and then got to know again in Chicago. I was teaching at the University of Chicago in those days.
That was in his lawyer capacity?
No, as a political figure.
Political figure?
Yeah.
Mm.
He may have given legal advice, but I think he was...
I think he was.
It's possible. Mm. It's possible. But he was, at that point, a sort of world figure, and was certainly more than that. The now, the Volta scheme was... as you know, quite a remarkable thing. It was to produce this huge Akasambo dam for hydroelectricity necessary for processing bauxite, of which Ghana had a great abundance. A huge new harbor was to be built at Tema, which I remembered originally as a fishing village, some 30 miles or so from Accra. It was to create the largest man-made lake in the world, and also to flood, for irrigation purposes, flood the Accra plains, which were alternatively very dry or very wet. And this fired the imagination of Nkrumah, and the conservative opposition to Nkrumah opposed it on the grounds that this was an imperialist plot. And of course, Nkrumah didn't take kindly to this sort of thing. So there was a kind of natural reaching out between the Kennedy administration people, the Kaiser Corporation, the British, who were supposed to finance the dam, and Nkrumah himself and the Convention People's Party. And all of this these things were taken as positive illustrations that radicalism shouldn't be taken too seriously. At the same time, Nkrumah was doing something quite differently. One of the reasons he wanted this was to have a kind of second coming. The first was his return from exile and taking over the country, and the second was to become the liberator of all of Africa under his particular domination. And he had, for this purpose, established what he called ministers plenipotentiary for trade union organizations, women's organizations, all the kind of voluntary organizations which had now been taken over by the Ghana government internally. And these ambassadors plenipotentiary were halfway between being officials of the government and representatives of these private or voluntary associations which were no longer voluntary. And these were his instruments for penetrating Africa. And at that point, he also began to rely on such protective groups as Soviet-trained regimental guards. Previously, the army had been under a British officer who brought the Ghanaian forces to the Congo, I might add, General Alexander.
Oh, yeah.
And that all began to change. And then he brought in two groups of Chinese under Huang Hua. Huang Hua had been Edgar Snow's translator and eventually became the foreign minister of China. Huang Hua helped to organize these two groups of essentially these two terrorist training camps, which were... Now, when the Americans got wind of these goings-on, also, companies like a big cereal company in Minnesota,
Kellogg. I thought of Kellogg, but that's not what you mean.
Well, it's the more overarching name. Pillsbury.
Pillsbury, yeah.
Pillsbury was trying to invest in a cereals growing project in processing and so forth. And many smaller companies were trying to invest. And there they came up against the kind of thing that later American investors found with the Chinese, just impossible to get any place to deal. And the rhetoric of Nkrumah began to move to the left. So on the one hand, he carried on these very successful and amicable relationships with Frank Knight of the Volta, what was called Valco, the company. And on the other hand, the rhetoric and the actual activities were becoming quite radicalized and indeed troublesome for the United States, with both Chinese and Soviet influence increasing rather rapidly. This is at the same time that Mali was perhaps the most Stalinist country. In West Africa, and the Guineans were were heavily pro-communist essentially. So this looked bad, and I remember being called in to consult on whether or not the United States should pull out of the Volta scheme. And I advised at that time no, because I thought we'd want to come back at a later point, and it would be very difficult, and that this would be actually a hold over the Ghanaians, rather than which we would lose if we pulled out. They needed it too much for both symbolic and actual reasons. Just as a footnote, they never did use the whole rationale of the scheme was to use the bauxite reserves of Ghana, which were never used. It was too expensive to move them from where they were to the smelter. They used bauxite from Guinea.
There is one Ghanaian who had a rather important role in the Congo, whose name was Gardner. I wonder, did you?
Yes, I knew him very well. He was originally a very interesting man. He was originally an extramurals lecturer in Nigeria. That's when I first met him. An extramurals lecturer is essentially a university teacher who teaches extension courses. He was a person of a great sense of personal propriety and dignity. And he was bitterly opposed to Nkrumah. He thought Nkrumah was a cheat, a fool, and so forth. However, eventually Gardner became chief establishment secretary in Ghana and in charge of the first Africanization program. And he was highly regarded and worked with the British to make the transition. once that transition was reasonably complete, and Gardner had Africanized the civil service, it became quite apparent what he had done. He peopled the civil service with those who would be resistant to politicization, which is exactly what Nkrumah wanted to do, at which point Gardner became very vulnerable. And I forget what happened. He was under a cloud for a while, and then he went to, eventually I think he headed up the UNDP.
That's right, he became a UN employee.
That's right, yeah. So I always thought he was a person who, because he was treated in a dismissive way, both by the British and by other more successful Africans when he was younger.
Mm.
And he had an extraordinary degree of pride and was extremely intelligent and closed-mouthed. He was a quiet, very quiet person. I think he also had a lot of real rage and political ambition, which he mastered very well. But he was too intelligent and too controlled and got on too well with Europeans for Nkrumah just to get rid of him. But Nkrumah got him out of the country and kept him out.
So thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Very interesting.